Hello. In recent audio snippets, we have been talking about slavery in America, and we talked a little bit in the last few snippets about what was happening in the world at the beginning of the 19th century. We talked about the awareness of the evil of maintaining slavery and how countries like the UK ended up abolishing slavery before America did. We talked about how in 1807 the slave trade was ended in both the UK and the US in literally the same month of that year, March of 1807. The British proceeded to abolish slavery in 1833 after abolishing the slave trade. And it was a gradual process of 5 years, and by 1838, slavery was gone, practically gone throughout the British Empire. There was a portion of the British Empire, a very small portion, that did maintain slavery under the act that had ended slavery, but even there, it was eventually eradicated. So as the British, who were the tyrants that we fought against for the sake of liberty and independence, as these tyrants were setting slaves free, the question becomes, what was going on in America? And that's kind of what we'll be talking about. We talked about important presidents and people at the beginning of the 20th century that could have turned the tide but didn't. We talked about James Monroe, the fifth president, and we talked about Henry Clay very briefly, And we also talked briefly about John Quincy Adams, the sixth president who followed James Monroe. And John Quincy Adams was the first president not to own any slaves, have owned any slaves in his lifetime. And he fought feverishly against slavery, but to no avail. He was like a lone voice in the wilderness in that regard. And then life went on. So the president who followed John Quincy Adams, the seventh president, was Andrew Jackson. And he was a president from 1829 to 1837. And he was a Southerner born in the middle in between North Carolina and South Carolina. So he was a Southerner from the Deep South. And he was a slave owner. And he was comfortable, you could say, with the concept of slavery from a practical perspective, to the point that at one point he put up rewards. At various times, he posted adverts for, offering rewards for slaves who had escaped from his plantation. There was an advert that he put up in 1804 where he offered $10 extra. I'm quoting, $10 extra for every 100 lashes any person will give him, referring to the slave, to the amount of 300. So he was saying, you capture the slave, and if you punish him for me, for every 100 lashes that you give him for having run away, I'll give you $10 extra in reward. So that's kind of the man who was in the White House between 1829 and 1837. During the time when the slaves were being set free throughout the British Empire. So it just gives you this contrast, stark contrast of what was happening in America versus the rest of the world, and especially Britain. Now the thing is that, ironically, despite this advert from 1804 that we just mentioned, Jackson would express concern for the treatment of slaves. And so I guess he was angry when a slave tried to get away from him. That's when he really got a little cruel. But if the slave kind of didn't try to run away, to him, it was important for the slave owner to treat the slave well. And he always attempted to keep slave families together. And he always urged his overseers, you know, the people who that he had overseeing the slaves, he urged them to treat the slaves with humanity. But so you would think, okay, he's a benevolent person in some ways, but you have to take it from the perspective that he believed in this kind of paternalistic concept of slavery, where slave ownership was morally acceptable. He had no moral qualms with slavery, but it stayed morally acceptable as long as the owner acted as this paternal, or I would say maternal figure, providing food, shelter, and whatever, you know, the slave needed. Like this guy who's going to take care of the slave, and as long as he takes care of the slave well, like a mother, like a hen over her chicks, then slavery is acceptable. That's how he saw it. And it's kind of similar. And Jackson was a Democrat, so it's kind of fitting that that's the mentality Democrats have always had, even to this day, with everything. You know, the government is this big hen that is to provide everything for everybody. And as long as these people stay within the covering of the hen, and just like Jackson, if anyone tries to get away from the covering of the government hen, then they get viciously attacked by Democrats, and smeared and politically destroyed or socially destroyed. As long as you submit, you'll be okay under the protection of the big mother hen. And they do the same thing with black people in a very particular way. As long as you stay Democrat, as long as you vote Democrat, as long as you keep us in power, we will try to get some freebies for you, some free mobile phones and more welfare and free cannabis or legalized cannabis and this, that, and the other. But if any black person tries to stray from the Democrat plantation, just like Clarence Thomas, who just Supreme Court justice, who doesn't think like a Democrat, if you as a black man dare to do that, if you stray from the covering of the mother hen, then you will get attacked and destroyed, and you will be lashed severely, figuratively, and I guess it's sometimes, yeah, even literally. So they have maintained the same mentality throughout. And it sounds like they care, but they really don't care because they don't believe, Democrats have never believed in the independence of black people as individuals, free individuals who don't depend on some mother hen, some big plantation owner to provide for them. So that we have continued in that mentality, at least on the Democrat side. And just to mention one of the things that kind of characterized this idiot's presidency was that in the summer of 1835, there were some northern abolitionists who decided to start like you could call a propaganda war or a war of information by sending these anti-slavery tracts into the South, and they would use postal mail for that. So they started mailing all these anti-slavery tracts, all this anti-slavery material into the South to kind of like stir the conscience of Southerners, and also stir black people kind of react to the slavery they were under. And Jackson was very displeased with this, and he and the Southerners began to complain to the U.S. Postal Service, which has always been corrupt. The U.S. Postal Service is a whore and a piece of trash in America. For any of you who are not in this country, the U.S. Postal Service is a piece of worthless trash. The thing is that the Southerners began to complain to the U.S. Postal Service, saying, "Hey, why are you delivering this mail?" And there were some riots as a result, because the Southerners wanted the white Southerners, obviously the slavery supporting white Southerners, wanted this to stop, and they went into they did some rioting, you know, Democrat style. You know, Democrats are like that. When they don't get their way, they just burst into riots. So nothing has changed for a long time. And so Jackson was against this mailing of anti-slavery material into the South. And he supported the Postmaster General's decision. The Postmaster General is the head of the U.S. Postal Service. And the Postmaster General came up with a solution to give discretionary powers to each state to either send or detain anti-slavery tracts. So basically, the U.S. Postal Service said, if you, the state, decide that you want to prevent this information getting out, then we will honor that. And that was a solution that the Postmaster General came up with, and Andrew Jackson supported it. In fact, even in December of 1835, Jackson went to Congress and asked them to ban the distribution of printed material that promoted any type of, you know, what he called, considered a slave insurrection. So he wanted Congress to enact laws from the federal level to prevent this type of anti-slavery, quote, agitation. And that's how that movement that could have started. You have to think about the context. This was the summer of 1835. In 1833, as we said already, the British had enacted the legislation to end slavery in a gradual way, and it was a 5-year process that ended in 1838. We're talking about the summer of 1835. So as slavery is being eradicated gradually from the British Empire, there was a movement in America, like a stirring, that, okay, we have to do something similar. I don't know if these northern abolitionists were motivated by what was happening in the British Empire, or if it was just like this thing that was happening, you know, in the atmosphere. And instead of just letting that movement flow, Andrew Jackson served as a way to contain it, and say, no, we are going to stay the way we are right now. Because all he wanted was like this stability, and he believed slavery was okay, and any attempt to end slavery was not only going to endanger a valid institution, but was going to endanger the Union, the country, in his view. And just to give you an idea of what type of a man this guy was, he promoted the forcible removal of Amerindians from lands in the South. And he's the culprit behind the famous Trail of Tears, that of all these Indian tribes that had to that were forcibly moved from their lands and were forced to go west. And a lot of them died during the migration, because it was this forcible migration, kind of like and it's interesting, socialists are always like that. They always believe there's an agenda, and big government socialists believe there's an agenda, and it's for the good of society, so we're going to do it, and no matter how much pain and suffering and torment it causes, we're going to do it. The same thing that Mao, Mao Zedong, who's burning in hell as I'm speaking, did in China back in the 60s, if I'm not mistaken, during the Cultural Revolution, where he forced many people to migrate to different parts of China. And I think he forced them to be in these collective farms. And during that migration, a lot of Chinese people died and were forced into harsh labor. So I don't know what it is about the Democrats, the socialists, and the big government people. Is this this is nothing unusual for them to do. So Andrew Jackson was doing it to the Amerindians. And there was a lot of death. And I think I've shared this before, that there is a connection, I think, between the Tornado Alley in the South and this forcible migration or removal of Amerindians in the South. It's as if it's a punishment over that part of the country in Oklahoma, Texas, that part of the South that has this Tornado Alley. It's this, almost like the consequence of what we did as a nation, and we are paying for it constantly. And it's like we don't, no one seems to awaken to the consciousness of what happened and what the right solution for the Amerindian is. To this day, we haven't solved the Amerindian problem. And we've talked about this before, that the Republicans pretend like nothing happened, and the Democrats just want to keep Amerindians in their reservations, and dying of alcoholism and depression and poverty and just running casinos and having no sense of purpose, because to the Democrat, that's the way to maintain the Amerindian culture, keep them separate so that they can preserve their useless culture, instead of telling them, hey, you are part of America, join the club, and we will help you assimilate and make this your nation, make this your country, instead of forcibly removing them. The thing is that, just to finish off talking about Andrew Jackson, he was largely responsible. A lot of his economic actions, which we will not go into detail here, had a lot to do with the panic of 1837 at the end of his... the year that he left office was 1837. At the beginning of 1837, that year there was a big panic, and that panic was caused by a lot of things he did near the end of his term. One of the things that he did is that he opposed the U.S. National Bank. I think he didn't renew the charter of the second U.S. National Bank or something to that effect. I know conservatives are always anti-national bank. It's a very stupid concept to have in one's mind. Oh no, we can't have a national bank. How can you have a nation without a national bank that defines the currency for the nation? It's mind-boggling how a conservative can take that stance. And you can understand why they take that stance, because of what the Federal Reserve has become. Because since we never allowed a real national bank to come about, then it came about by circumstance, because we had no other choice. We were not allowing the actual proper solution to be manifested. So an artificial solution came up, which is the Federal Reserve, which is, for all intents and purposes, the national bank, but it has private interests in it, and it's not run by the government. It's run by this group of people, separate group of people that no one knows about, or that are not elected. And so it's kind of very sinister in that sense. And they control things, and they kind of collect on the banking activity. It's as if they are there, they are private citizens, and they are there collecting a toll, you could say, on the transactions that are happening in the banking industry. How can you give private people that kind of power? So it's a mixture of private and public, in a sense, but we have, as a people, no control over it, no real control. The only thing that I think we have indirect control over is who is the chairman of the Federal Reserve, because he is appointed by the president, or the so-called president, and we elect the so-called president. We supposedly, quote-unquote, elect the so-called president, and so that's how we indirectly can affect the Federal Reserve. But the thing, and we've talked about how the problem with the Federal Reserve is not just the nature of it, but what it does. And we briefly talked about that in a previous audio snippet, that the money supply is controlled in a very, very wrong way. And if we change the way we control the money supply, tying it to the gold, to a gold standard or a silver standard, because as we explained before, that is completely artificial and is contrary to the concept of what money is. And conservatives hate fiat currency. They hate it. And they say we have to be tied to gold. Well, why gold? So if a country finds a gold mine and becomes rich just by having a gold mine, they didn't produce anything else and now they're rich. It doesn't make any sense, any real sense. It had sense in the ancient world when there were no macroeconomic parameters that people could go by. It was a different time. So gold was an okay way to go, but not anymore. Money is supposed to be a point system. And as long as we keep the point system consistent with the wealth that's being created, then we'll be okay. So we explained that you know, money, it should be a constitutional clause that no one decides how to increase or decrease the money supply. It's not decided by Congress, not decided by a Federal Reserve Board, not decided by anyone. It's a very fixed objective guideline. The money supply grows with the GDP. If the GDP grows 5%, then the money supply will grow 5%. And the money supply is not to grow by injection of money through government expenditures, because that's the Keynesian model. And the Keynesian model had a certain validity to it because it was trying to increase the money supply that was being artificially kept low by the gold standard. But the problem is that in Keynesian economics, when the government starts spending money, it's the government, like a drunken sailor, buying things or resources that may or may not be useful. So we explained in a previous audio snippet that the mechanism should be that the new money that's going to be injected into the economy is injected in a proportionate way, distributed across the banking system, and the banking system cannot use that money for themselves. It's just available to provide loans. So it's not money that's spent. It's money that's made available for investment in the form of loans. And then the banks can benefit from that through the interest they collect. But it's not their money. And it's not being spent, but it's being given to the bank. We explained all of that in detail before. And if we went that route, we would totally transform the economic system. We could have a national bank without a concern about any sort of sinister characters behind the scenes, behind some smokescreen and so forth. But returning to Jackson banned the National Bank and did other stupid things that led to the Panic of 1837. And that led to a four-year depression, literally. The country went through a four-year depression until 1841. So now we're going to go into the next president. And as a side note, the reason why we're going through all these details, it's a bit laborious. And you could go, what's the point of rehashing all these failures and talking about what we did wrong over and over and over again? The reason why we're doing this and going through the details of going through each president and going one by one and showing what was wrong is to kind of point out the futility that's inherent in the American way of thinking, that Americans are very, very slow. We as a people are very slow in reacting to do what has to be done. It's as if we just keep pretending like everything is okay, and we're doing it all over again. We're doing it right now, at the moment as we speak, at the time of this recording. Abortion has become a big issue again in America because the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, the case back in 1971, I think, or in the 70s, that that basically legalized abortion in America, and it was overturned. And now, but it was not overturned, meaning there's no more abortions in America. It means now the states get to decide on abortion. So in a Democrat-run state, abortion is going to be legal and just arbitrarily available. And in more conservative states, then it's going to be restricted, if not eliminated. And conservatives are happy with that. And obviously, Democrats are unhappy with that because it's always their way or no way at all. And some of them have turned to rioting and things like that, and doing acts of vandalism and so forth, because they are crybabies. It's always they have to get everything that they want, and if they don't get everything that they want, they throw a wobbly, they throw this temper tantrum. And try to destroy anything and anyone who has dared to not give them 100% of what they want. And conservatives, on the other hand, are happy with it, and they consider it like, oh, okay, this is the way it should be. And I think I mentioned before this headline that I saw of a conservative saying, oh, this is wonderful, this is divorce American style. And he was praising it as this wonderful thing, a country that's now in a state of divorce where some states will allow abortions and other states will not. And I go, my goodness, haven't we gone through this before? Wasn't this the same problem with slavery? And then I say to myself, well, so you're saying that in California, where it will be legal, and I'm pretty sure that they're going to expand abortion as much as possible, with the son of a bitch will burn in hell very soon, that worthless bastard boy, Gavin Newsom, in power there at the time of this recording, then is a conservative actually saying that, oh, okay, I don't care, now we have this state of things where each state decides, then If a fetus happens to be conceived in California and it gets aborted, tough luck. You know, like if a fetus is lucky enough to get conceived in California, unlucky enough to get conceived in California, then, well, you know, we throw our hands up and say, sorry, man, you know, tough luck, man. You should have been conceived in Alabama or Mississippi or someplace like that. Is that the right moral attitude to have? And you can say, well, we can't force it on people. Yeah, but we don't. The thing is, it's not a matter of forcing it on people or not. The fetus has no voice in this. The fetus cannot defend itself. We can't just say, we can't just talk about this as if there's no fetus involved here. The fetus is going to get killed in California. It's going to get killed in Washington. It's going to get killed in Oregon. Well, then are you saying that we should force people not to have abortions? Well, yes and no, but not in the way that you would think. The thing is, we have to, regardless of whether the idiots in California want to abort their babies or not, or the idiots in Washington State or Oregon, those stupid states on the West Coast, regardless of whether they want to do it or not, we have to think about the fetus inside. And we have to then address the issue, okay, how do we defend the fetus? How do we go through the process of getting to the point where it will become inevitable that the fetus has to be defended? And to get to that, we have to re-examine our Constitution. These people who are saying, okay, we have divorce American style, wonderful. Now we can ban abortion in this one state and protect babies here. And if someone wants to protect their babies, they can come to this state or whatever. It's those people who are saying that don't stop to think, okay, how can we still have abortions going on in California? If we are upholding the Constitution, how can fetuses be terminated in California and Washington and Oregon? They don't realize, well, how can we have this state of madness while the Constitution is still valid in their eyes? Because there is nothing unconstitutional about committing abortion. That's just the reality, and they don't see that. It's in front of them, and they're willing to see it or recognize it or admit to it, that the current American Constitution that they worship, that the founding fathers left behind, does not protect the life of fetuses. And you could say, well, that, and we've said this a million times before, but I'll say it again. Well, some people will argue, well, you're so naive. How can you expect the founding fathers to know that we were going to be aborting fetuses willy-nilly 200 years later? It's not their fault, and there was no abortion back in the day. You're missing the point. When people go like that, they are missing the point. Because as we've tried to explain a million times before, the right to life is not in the Constitution. The Constitution does not protect the right to life of the born, not the unborn, the born, the ones who have been born, do not have their right to life protected by the Constitution. It's not there. The Constitution does not define the right to life. Some might say, oh, well, I heard someone say the right to life, you know, we have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That's in the, that's not a legal statement. It's not in the Constitution. That, if I remember correctly, is in the Declaration of Independence. We declaring independence from Great Britain, and it's just a little phrase inside a paragraph, but it's not legally binding. It doesn't really say anything. It doesn't clarify what do we mean by that. So, and we went through the laborious task of defining the right to life, how it will be defined in the new American Constitution if we survive to and do not die within 16 or 14 months. If we survive as a republic and we finally draft this new American Constitution, then in that Constitution, we went through the laborious effort of defining what life is. When we're talking about life, it's not just physical, biological life. We can take the concept of biological life and then extend it and use it as a model to understand what life in a more general sense is. And that's what we did in a previous audio snip, in previous audio snippets. And we can then define the right to life. And then we can start including the right to life of animals, as we explained in great detail before. And as you start explaining all of that, then we start defining a philosophical framework that we can then take and say, hey, this is making it very clear that we cannot be aborting fetuses, human fetuses, any longer. Because it violates all these principles that we have laid out in the Constitution. So it's not just an argument of he said, she said. that's the way we always fight with the liberals. Conservatives are always fighting with the liberals, like, oh no, abortion is murder. No, abortion is a right. Abortion is murder. Abortion is a right. And then we just throw it back and forth, and no one has had the moral clarity or the philosophical mental clarity or spiritual clarity to define it properly. This is what life is. And as you can see, as you start explaining it, then that and if it's in a legal document, then we can have legal battles over it in a battlefield where the rules are more clearly defined, where we can defend a fetus. Remember, a fetus cannot defend itself, himself or herself. He cannot defend himself. We have to defend them and fight for them. We are to fight for the defenseless. And that's what the Democrats always claim to be doing, but they're hypocrites. They don't care. For them, it's just a matter of convenience. That's all it is, a matter of convenience. And this is not a fight about defending the people or the creatures that cannot defend themselves, in this case, these fetuses. And we don't even have to get to the discussion of whether or not they're human beings or not. It's not even relevant. And that's the thing, when we get into this discussion, are they human beings or are they not human beings? Well, if you define the right to life in the proper way, that question becomes irrelevant. Like, for example, you don't care about a dog not being a human when you treat him fairly. If someone mistreats a dog, look at the ASPCA and all these other organizations that go to the ends of the earth to rescue a dog from cruelty. It's not a human being. It's a life. It's a life form. And as such, it needs to be protected and defended. They can't vote. They can't speak for themselves, just like a fetus. And then you can start talking about other examples, like for example, someone kicks a pregnant woman. There is horror, there's a sense of horror in all of us that he didn't just kick a woman, he kicked a woman with a life inside of it. Don't we always use the expression, oh, there's a life growing inside of me? You know, when women are talking about their babies, there's a life, I'm amazed that there's a life growing inside of me. We all know, we all verbalize it without meaning to. We know there's a life in there. And if someone comes and kicks the baby, a pregnant woman, clearly pregnant woman, in the stomach, we all are horrified by it because he didn't just attack a woman, he attacked a little life form inside of her. And how can a woman come and decide this thing inside of me deserves to live or deserves to die? When did the woman become God in deciding who lives and who dies? Like, oh, okay. Oh, if she doesn't care for the baby, like, let's say she was on her way to the abortion clinic when this guy came and kicked her, then it's okay. You know, then whatever damage the guy did to the fetus is irrelevant. We don't care about it. Now, you wouldn't think that way. It's like, how can the woman decide now this life form? There's no consideration for it. We don't have to worry about treating it with respect. Let's say that there's a woman, a pregnant woman, on a subway car, a train car, and she's standing up. A lot of people, you know, get up and offer their seats to the pregnant woman because you want to protect that little life form, protect her and protect that little life form inside of her. Does this mean that if she is on her way to the abortion clinic, then we shouldn't even get up to let her sit down because, you know, she has decided that life is not worth protecting or worth caring for? See, the thing is, if we define these principles in the Constitution, as we tried to explain in previous audio snippets, then we have the legal battleground, the moral, the philosophical battleground to then end abortion. And have people become convinced this is the wrong thing to do. And we can win legal battles, and then slowly the culture will change. But we go into this mode where we don't admit the system is broken. the Constitution is a piece of trash. The current American Constitution is a piece of trash. Let's just put it that way. It worked for a certain time, to a certain extent, and it was a revolutionary document in some ways back in the 1800s, to a certain extent. And I say that in a very limited way, a very qualified way. But it doesn't work. It's metaphysically unsound. It is so poorly written, so poorly framed, so poorly philosophically, so poorly conceptualized that it just does not work. And as long as we keep going to this idea that no, we have a good system, it's just the evil Democrats, evil liberals who are destroying the country, then we will never get out of this. And this is what we're trying to show here as we go through each president, this lingering sense of no, everything is okay, we just have to keep going the way we are. It is frustrating because liberals don't want to change for the better. They just want to end, finish their destruction. That's what their intent is. The hope is with the people who are not liberals, the people who have a little bit of common sense in them, and most of them are conservatives. But even then, they get trapped in this mindset of stagnation. And that's what we said before, the real swamp. The conservatives always refer to the Democrats as the swamp people. The swamp people are the conservatives, because a swamp is a place of stagnant water. They are the people of no movement, the people of let's just stay the way we are, let's just try to make it work within the confines of our limited world, instead of saying we have to redo the world, we have to restructure it, we have to create a new world order. And I know that phrase is shocking or to a conservative. I'm not referring to the new world order of the liberals. Don't be an idiot. That's not what I'm referring to. But we need a new world order. The current world order, the conservative world, does not work. It just does not work. And this is why we're going through this exercise of showing how slavery just kept being protected, and we never took action until the Civil War. But the thing is, because of how protracted it was, even after we had the Civil War and even after we ended slavery, then we didn't act. We kind of went back to the old behavior and didn't finish the job. And we'll get all the way to 1874 and talk about how the sad 1874 is one of the saddest years in American history. And when we get to it, we will explain why. That's the, you could say, the beginning of the end of the American Republic in many ways. And then from then on, it just went downhill because of this protracted behavior, this foot-dragging behavior that we've had in our history. And that's what I'm trying to portray shed a light on here. So now that we've talked about Andrew Jackson, let's talk quickly about the next president, Martin Van Buren, who was the vice president to Jackson. He was a one-term president from 1837 to 1841. And he was one of the founders of this, New Democratic Party that Andrew Jackson kind of made very popular. Andrew Jackson was a bit of a, what I would consider a, he was a, I don't know if the word is rabble-rouser, but maybe the a bit of a demagogue. That's what how I perceive him. He kind of made politics very popular, and he kind of approached the common man in that sense. He stirred people to political movement. So there was a bit of demagoguery in him, the way I perceive him. And so he kind of formed this new Democratic Party. And And Martin Van Buren was also very instrumental in this founding or establishing of the Democratic Party. And he's also very relevant in the forging of the two-party system that America eventually developed or grew into. This Martin Van Buren was born in New York. So he was not a Southerner. He was from New York. He had like a change of heart later on, but unfortunately it happened after he was president. While he was president, he kind of continued Jackson's policies, including Jackson's Amerindian removal policy. And that caused him problems because that led to what I believe is called the Second Seminole War down in the South in the Florida area. If I'm not mistaken, there was a war with the Amerindians. That was caused by this forcible removal policy, and that was a bit of a drag on his presidency. He opposed abolitionism. That's how he was against slavery, but he opposed the efforts to abolish it, because to him, it was more important to preserve the Union. He thought slavery was immoral, but sanctioned by the Constitution, he felt that the federal government does not have the power to end slavery in the states. Kind of the same thing as conservatives nowadays think that you cannot, that the federal government should not have the power to legalize abortion. That's a state issue. And when they bring it down to the federal level, what they're doing is, as we've explained before, they're just pretending the problem is not there and just localizing it. So this Martin Van Buren, being a Democrat, was of that mentality. He was the tie-breaking vote in the Senate to defer to states the authority of the propaganda that was anti-slavery propaganda that the North was mailing to the South. If I'm not mistaken, he was a tie-breaking vote in the Senate to defer to states the authority over this abolitionist mail that Andrew Jackson opposed. He was a compromiser on the issue of slavery, and that's how he won the election in 1836, because the people in the South, the Southern pro-slavery people, saw him as an ally. But in the North, he was not repugnant enough because he was also opposed to slavery. So he was opposed to slavery. He spoke about it as an immoral thing. But he said, he would raise his hands and say, oh, but we can't do anything about it because the federal government does not have power over that. If you're going to deal with it, it has to be at the state level. So that's how he appealed enough to the Southerners to have them vote for him, and enough to the Northerners to not vote for him. The thing is that he was a one-termer because the Panic of 1837 that Andrew Jackson started kind of went on throughout his whole presidency, and he wasn't capable of stopping the panic. And ironically, the panic ended as his presidency ended as well, or the depression that followed. But in his retirement, he began to grow in his opposition to slavery. He published this anti-slavery manifesto that came to be known as the Barn Burner Manifesto, in which he refuted the notion that Congress did not have the power to regulate slavery in the territories. So he basically started backtracking on his belief that the federal government does not have the authority to end slavery, that the national government. I hate the word federal government because I, as you know, federalism, I'm against federalism because, as we've clearly shown, I believe, in these audio snippets, federalism is fundamentally flawed. It's based on, it stinks of elitism. And we have explained that in detail before. So let's say national government, that's a more proper term. So he refuted the notion that Congress, part of the national government, did not have the power to regulate slavery in the territories, and he argued that the founding fathers had favored the eventual abolition of slavery. So he kind of made this argument that the founding fathers saw slavery as something that had to be gradually removed from the American culture. So, and this Barn Burner Manifesto became very popular, and to the point that he ended up being promoted to kind of be the leader of what came to be kind of organically became the Free Soil Party that promoted the end of slavery in America. That's why it was called the Free Soil Party. And he was the candidate for the Free Soil Party in 1848, in fact. So in other words, 8 years after, or yeah, basically 8 years after he had left office, he tried to win the election again as this third party candidate, but he only won 10% of the vote, which in fact was the strongest showing for any third party candidate in U.S. history up until that point. And I think that after that, there might have been one more person that got more third party votes than him. I'm not sure. Maybe Ross Perot or someone to that effect. I remember in 1980, John Anderson was a third party candidate. When Reagan and Carter went against each other, but I think he only got 5% of the vote. The thing is that he had a big change of heart, but it was like a little too little too late. He had this change of heart after he had left the presidency. But we see this example of a person who knows slavery is wrong, but doesn't do anything about it. Just like Jackson, who, he believed slavery was okay, but as long as he treated the slaves nicely and in a maternalistic mother hen type of way. And then just the problem just kept going on and on. So the next president after him, the ninth president, was William Henry Harrison. Son of a bitch was actually the son of Benjamin Harrison, the fifth, I think, who was a founding father, one of the founding fathers of the country. So he was the son of a founding father. And that's very relevant. He was from Virginia, and he was pro-slavery through and through. And he died 31 days into his presidency. And I believe that he was like a symbolic figure of, okay, the slaves are free in the British Empire. It's 1841. They were set free by end of August of 1838. And now we have the first president elected in America after slavery has ended in the British Empire, William Henry Harrison. The son of a founding father, in other words, the son of a man who fought against the British, who are now setting the slaves free. I hope you see the poetic figure in all of this. That this man who was the son of a founding father who fought against the British, calling them tyrants. He is the president now, right after the tyrants that his father fought against have set the slaves free. And he, instead of having a change of heart, saying, okay, let's end this nonsense, he was very strongly pro-slavery. And thankfully, the son of a bitch died 31 days into his presidency. It's as if he was divinely cut short, you know, like, okay, you go to hell, you will die. That's what I think of you, because you, the son of a founding father who fought against the British for independence and freedom and liberty, are maintaining an oppression that those tyrants that your father railed against, maintaining an oppression that those tyrants are now ending. So he died, and his vice president, John Tyler, took over. And this was the first time that an American president died in office. And ironically, this created a brief constitutional crisis, because the Constitution, the brilliant Constitution that the Founding Fathers, one of which was William Henry Harrison's father, this brilliant, brilliant Constitution did not clearly state how a succession was going to happen if a president died in office. It wasn't clear. So there was a constitutional crisis in the country. I mean, just think about this. That's how badly written that document is. It is badly, badly written. So the thing is that they had a constitutional crisis and eventually got settled, because they didn't even know, okay, now that this guy died, now is the vice president the new president, or is he just has the responsibilities of president? They didn't know what to make of things. But eventually they decided, no, yeah, let's make John Tyler the president. He's the president now. And he became the president. And he too was born in Virginia into a slaveholding family, a strong supporter of state rights and slavery, just like William Henry Harrison, whom he replaced. And the son of a bitch, late years later, 20 years later, supported the South in 1861. When the Civil War broke out in 1861, he said, "I'm going to support the South," and he even won a seat to the Confederate House of Representatives. So he not only decided to support the South, he was elected to the Confederate Congress, or House of Representatives. He won a seat, but then he died, so the son of a bitch didn't get a chance to be a Confederate congressperson. And he died in 1862. And because he died in 1862 in the South as a Confederate, he is the only president whose death was never honored in Washington. Jefferson Davis was the son of a bitch president of the Confederate States of America, the South. Did the ceremony in honor of John Tyler, and he had his coffin draped in the Confederate flag, and he was buried like that. And he's the only president in American history whose coffin was draped in a flag other than the American flag, of another country, because basically the Confederates were another country. And he's the only president who had that dishonor. And it's interesting that it happened. He's the one who replaced William Henry Harrison, who had this poetic kind of moment. He was like a representation of everything that was wrong with slavery in this country. This John Tyler, who replaced William Henry Harrison, in a sense, John Tyler was the continuation of William Henry Harrison's presidency. He is the only president who died in dishonor, the honor draped in the flag of another country, not the American flag. And he, ironically, he also regarded slavery as an evil, being a slave owner and all. But he never attempted to justify slavery, so he never tried to rationalize it. Unlike Andrew Jackson, for example, but he never freed any of his slaves. So he thought it was wrong. He said, "I'm not going to justify it. This is wrong, totally wrong." But he kept the slaves and never freed any of them. He didn't even try to free them. That's the dichotomy that we have in this country, where we try to do two completely opposite things and try to keep them together. This schizophrenia that we have in this country, and that's how slavery just continued. That's how we continue with this decrepit constitutional system that we have in America, and I know that irritates a conservative when they hear it, because they don't understand the spirit with which I'm saying it. I'm not saying it as a liberal. You have to understand that. Stop associating labels to things and thinking, if he said that, that means he's saying this, because I am saying we have a system that's broken and we need to fix it. We only have like 16 months left. That's how much time we have. And then, or less, I don't know the exact number, but we have very little time. And then this country will die if we don't realize that we need to revamp the whole system. And we need a new American constitution. And we need to fight things in a different way. But okay. So we have spoken about let's see, 1, 2, 3 presidents so far. Andrew Jackson, I'm sorry, 4. Martin Van Buren, William Henry Harrison, and John Tyler. Then after John Tyler came James K. Polk, who was president from 1845 to 1849. He was like he was born in North Carolina, so he was another Southerner. And he owned many slaves. And in fact, whilst president, he increased his slave ownership. So whilst he was in the White House, he acquired more slaves. So he wasn't just maintaining the slaves he had. He was growing his slave population. But the weird thing is, in his will, which was dated February 28, 1849, like shortly before he left the White House, if I'm not mistaken, a few days before his presidency ended, he wrote this will that contained a non-binding expectation that his slaves were to be freed when both he and his wife Sarah died. So he didn't want to free the slaves after his death, because he wanted to make sure that his wife had a slave population to work for her and keep her well until she died. So the thing is, so he knew slavery was wrong. He knew it. It's like we all knew it. It's like John Tyler knew it. And this James K. Polk knew it. Andrew Jackson knew it, but he knew it less. And Martin Van Buren kind of also knew it was wrong, but he went along with it until he had his change of heart. But James K. Polk had in his will this thing that he wanted to free the slaves, but only after I'm gone, like, because I won't need them anymore. As long as I am alive, I need them, and I need to maintain my wealth. So when it no longer becomes convenient, then I will set them free. I mean, that's how sad the thing was. But the ironic thing is that his wife, and this was in Mississippi. He had bought a plantation in Mississippi, and that's where he and his wife were to live out the rest of their days. But his wife Sarah lived until 1891. Imagine that, until 1891. So if it had been according to his will, imagine how long the slaves would have had to live. And I believe that's just poetic, a poetic representation of how even his good intentions just didn't mean good results. And that's what would have happened in America had we not ended slavery with the Civil War. It would have gone on. I'm pretty sure it would have gone on well into the 20th century, into the 1940s. I can assure you, that's how long it would have gone. And it might have gone on even longer than that. But by then, I think the American nation would be dead, because I think there is no way this country would have survived morally, spiritually, in any way, with slavery still going on that long. But so this woman died until 1891, but the slaves were freed in 1865 by the 13th Amendment. So it wasn't by Polk's will that the slaves were free. They were free because of the Civil War that ended in 1865, and then we had the 13th Amendment that ended slavery officially. But ironically, and this is also poetically fitting, Sarah Polk sold half of her interest in the plantation to a guy. I think he paid like $28,500, you know, of the in those days, to own half the plantation and the slaves. That meant that she no longer had the power to free them because, you know, the other half who owned the plantation had to agree to set them free. And it would have been very unlikely that a person who just paid $28,500 in 19th century money would have been willing to let just the slaves free. He just paid for the slaves, and now we're going to set them free. Obviously, that was never going to happen. So even if the slaves had not been set free in the Civil War, they would not have been set free at Sarah Polk's death, because she sold half the plantation. It's a poetic reflection of the half-heartedness that America has always had. It's like, we kind of do, we kind of don't. We kind of do, we kind of don't. And that's the spirit of compromise. And that's why, you know, Democrats and politicians are always talking about the importance of compromise. And when someone's always compromising, they see it as, oh, that's so noble and diplomatic. And yes, that he's not an ideologue, and he's a practical person. He's not a crazy nut job politician. This guy knows how to do things in Washington. He can compromise. But compromise is how we get into deeper and deeper trouble. Just look at how protracted slavery was because of the spirit of compromise. Henry Clay was always, as we said before, praised as one of the great statesmen of America in American history, because he would be wheeling and dealing and trying to get people to work together and compromise. He was the moving force behind the compromise of 1850, the Missouri Compromise of 1850, that only prolonged problems with regards to slavery. But we have always seen it as, we tend to see it as a wonderful thing, a compromiser. No. Compromise is when you start doing things half-heartedly, halfway here, halfway there, then you get nothing done at the end. The thing is that, to Polk, who fought the Mexican-American War, and one of his great achievements was that he expanded the U.S. greatly, because this guy, to him, slavery was a non-issue. Expansion of the U.S. was a problem during slavery, because they always had the concern that if we expand the U.S. and add another state or another territory, do we allow slavery? Do we not allow slavery? Then the South is going to say, let's allow slavery. The North is going to say, let's not allow slavery in this new territory. So expansion was always a problem. That's why there was so much trouble in allowing Texas to be allowed into the Union. And that was one of the problems that another president had. But we'll talk about that later. The thing is that he didn't care. This James K. Polk just said, let's expand. He believed in the manifest destiny of America, of expanding. And he just conquered. He was the president during the Mexican-American War that expanded American territory. And so he was very successful in that. Because he didn't, we will worry about slavery later, because I'm okay with slavery anyway, so it's not an issue to him. Slavery was an annoying distraction in the task of expanding the American nation. So we couldn't grow because we were stuck in this dilemma. And he just went ahead and grew, but he didn't deal with the dilemma. And he pledged to serve only one term, and he did. And he died in 1849 in Tennessee. So he left in 1849, that same year he died. He died in Tennessee, where he wanted to retire with his wife after a tour of the South. So he left the White House, he went on this grand parade throughout the South, and everybody in the South was, oh yeah, hooray, hooray, here comes James K. Polk. He arrived in Tennessee, and then he died. He didn't get to enjoy anything after having been president. So, and I think we will leave it at that, and we'll continue with the other presidents in a future audio snippet. And I know this is laborious, but it's important to show how we in America have this tendency to drag things out without clearly defining things as they should be. And we're doing it all over again, because this is what I want to emphasize. We're repeating the same problem all over again, but this time it's going to have permanent consequences. The nation is about to die in around 14 months, if I'm not mistaken. And if something dramatic does not happen within the next 14 months, the American experiment is over. It's completely over. We're talking about the drafting of a new American Constitution, and if it's not done in America, it will be done somewhere else. But the Constitution that we have been describing will be plastered at some point, somewhere, somehow. It's just a matter of us deciding, do we want to be the ones to do it? And I don't know when or where, but this will not be left undone, regardless of America's stupidity. So we'll continue with the next president in the next audio snippet. Thank you very much.